Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Judith Wood for the petitioner.
Yeah. Don't we have any more light here? Let's see.
Islas Martinez?
More light, you know.
No, they're not. They're off in the back of the courtroom.
Yeah, they're off. They can we got to raise them, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, all right. We'll issue flashlights. Can you see all right?
I can see.
Okay.
Can you see me?
Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
I got you.
This case involves several issues, Your Honor. It actually mirrors a very famous case, which I'm sure you're all aware of, which is Matter of R.A., which is currently still held in abeyance, which is why there's been some procedural confusion in this case as well. The Attorney General requested that in the R.A. case, both sides, the petitioner and the respondent, file briefs regarding their opinion about whether R.A. Met the qualifications for belonging to a social group. And in the Department of Homeland Security brief, which was filed on February 14, 2004, the Department of Homeland Security defines the social group, redefines it as, quote, a woman in Guatemala who is unable to leave the relationship. That's R.A. And married woman in Guatemala who is unable to leave the relationship.
You know, can I short-circuit this a little bit? I'm familiar with the progress of the opinion coming out in R.A., the Attorney General asking for withdrawal and reconsideration, and then nothing more coming out of the AG's office. So I know this. But I'm focusing on the difficulties of this case in relation not only to a matter of R.A., but more broadly. I mean, we've got two petitions here. One of them is from the March 2002 BIA affirmance of the denial of application for cancellation of removal. And the other one is a petition for review of the BIA's denial of motion to reconsider in July 2004.
Right.
Now,
I'm trying
now,
to address that.
Your focus in the briefs, I think, has not been on the March 2002 order, because there had been a waiver, that is to say they conceded removability, and then they had trouble proving it, and the question of cancellation of removal and qualification we really don't have any jurisdiction over. So the focus is on the petition for review of the 2004 order. Is that right?
Well, they kind of bleed together, Your Honor, and the reason why is because
How do we have any jurisdiction over the 2002 order when the only question in that order, the only question decided by the BIA was that they were not entitled to cancellation or removal because of insufficient hardship?
Well, in the 2002 order, we believe that the legal definition of severely unusual, extreme and unusual and extremely unusual and severe hardship was not properly adjudicated by the immigration judge. The immigration judge.
I see. So you're saying the wrong legal standard was applied.
Right. The immigration judge originally, in the first instance, regarded the hardship to have to be an unconscionable harm. But later on, the BIA redefined the level of hardship to be less than unconscionable in various cases like Montreal. And if you put together the facts of this case, where the woman might actually be killed by her prior husband if she was sent back to El Salvador, at least she would suffer severe harm, as she already has, that would up the level of hardship to the children as well, if you take the two cases as a whole, if you look at it in a holistic way, if you will. But the
So the easiest way to hold in your favor in this case would simply be to go back and just to grant and remand to the BIA on what constitutes sufficient hardship?
Well,
to say under the proper standard, because obviously we can't get into their factual determination as to what hardship is or isn't.
Right, you can't. And so
is that going to do? Is that going to do?
There is a legal issue in the parameters of what constitutes.
But will hardship. will that in fact do you any good? Because hardship really is, as it's currently defined, I mean, we don't have any jurisdiction to decide it, but I think it's a loser.
You don't have jurisdiction for discretionary, but the legal, the way the immigration judge...
No, I understand that. I've got a different question. If we send it back to the BIA for a redetermination under the proper legal standard, whether they're entitled to cancellation of removal, as a practical matter, I don't see the facts that's going to get them that.
Well, of course, if it's remanded to the BIA, they'll remand it to the immigration judge for a hearing on asylum, because...
Well, why would they do that? Because in that first one, they conceded removability. So that question's gone from that case. The only way you can get back at that question is under ineffective assistance of counsel.
Removability doesn't cause a person to give up their asylum case. If a respondent concedes removability...
Did they waive their asylum claim in front of the IJ?
She can still go forward with asylum before the IJ.
I asked the question.
She did not
waive the asylum claim in front of the IJ?
She didn't waive it. She simply said things are rough in El Salvador. No one ever questioned her about what actually... That's the whole problem with this case. This woman was severely tortured and threatened
Her lawyer withdrew the application for asylum. Isn't that what happened? When was that, August?
Unfortunately, that's the practice in Los Angeles. And so far as if you want to go forward with a cancellation case, has to withdraw the asylum case.
I didn't ask it properly, but that was my question. So how does she have a live asylum claim if we remand on the 2002 order?
Well, she can withdraw the withdrawal of the original asylum claim, which was taken, in 1997, years before R.A. was heard. And I think the original hearing was in 1997, before with prior counsel. And no one ever – the crux of this matter is that no one ever talked to this woman. No one ever asked her what happened.
Well, I understand that. And you've got, it seems to me, a fairly good ineffective assistance of counsel claim. The trouble with that one is that's not raised until the second petition, and that one was pretty darn late. That is to say, your office was representing her at the time she files the motion to reopen, which is denied and not appealed from. Then you make the second motion to reconsider quite some time after that. And I think you need sort of a recent discovery of ineffective assistance of counsel in order to excuse what would otherwise be the untimeliness. How do I get past that one? I have to say I'm sympathetic with your client, and I'm trying to figure out how to get there.
I realize that, Your Honor. The reason for the motion to reconsider filed when it was, we filed it after the Department of Homeland Security came out with their brief, which defined the social group and found that actually RA should get asylum, made their opinion that RA, which this case is very similar to, should get asylum, that she is eligible for asylum, but redefine the social group.
Where in the record do you say to the BIA that that's your reason that why you should be excused from late filing, that is to say the filing of that brief by the Homeland Security?
Well, we go through a whole discussion of the vicissitudes of what happened with the RA.
I ask you a very precise question, I'll ask it now a slightly different way. When you filed the motion to reconsider in front of the BIA, now this is the second basic motion to reconsider in front of the BIA, did you at that time say, here's why we are doing this late and here's why we should be excused from what would otherwise be an untimely filing? We are keying off of the filing of the Homeland Security brief, because once that's filed, we've got new law. Where did you say that? Did you say that?
I'm pretty sure we mentioned it.
Where?
I'll have to look. I really don't have it at my fingertips, Your Honor.
Well, because I read your papers last night, uh-huh. And I don't recall having seen it.
I'd be fumbling through these papers to get it for you.
Okay.
There's another issue in this case.
You talked about the facts that were previously unavailable, the molestation by the grandfather. Is that?
Well, the facts
on
were
the basis
available.
Of, let's see, that I think your second motion to reopen was in July of 2004.
Right. And that motion to reopen came after the DHS issued their brief. But The facts, her underlying facts were available. We've made an argument that she, and in fact, suffered from severe post-traumatic stress syndrome and never was able to confide in anyone what had happened to her in El Salvador at the hands of her prior husband. And until many years after the case was concluded, when I met her and I actually sort of saw on her face, in a way, it's hard to explain that in legalese, but I just saw her suffering, and I asked her what happened, and she sort of whispered to me in my office that her husband had killed his prior wife and threatened to kill her, and all these horrific events. And the reason why it's almost a twin to the Guatemalan case, because he too had been in the military, and she couldn't really escape from him, even though she tried to. So it's so similar to RA. And as RA evolved, we thought, well, maybe we'll get an audience with this court now that the Department of Homeland Security has found that RA, in fact, was eligible. There was all this discussion, and kind of the case was held in abeyance as to whether or not RA fell into a protected social group. And when the case still isn't decided, but if RA falls into a social group, there remains an issue for this court. Let's say the court decides that RA gets asylum. I still have an issue with this case.
I understand. I mean, I'm quite familiar with the sort of the justice of her claim, or maybe I'll say the injustice of the things that have been done to her and the things that she's worried about. But I'm concerned procedurally as to how I get there. And this second motion, the 2004 motion, was filed late. And what rationale do you have that will help us say it doesn't matter that it was filed late?
Well, the promulgation, everything was held in abeyance, and then the Department of Homeland Security issued their brief, which set out the fact that they thought RA should get asylum. So if RA should get asylum, there's a good case for Islas Martinez getting asylum.
Who held it in abeyance?
What?
Who held this case in abeyance?
The attorney, not this case, RA.
Oh, I thought you said
this case. No, this case mirrors RA, so we've kind of tracked RA in working on this case.
Let's say that's a given.
That RA should get asylum. There's still an issue in this case, and that's an issue that I want you to consider. In the DHS brief, they say that the social group is defined as a married woman in Guatemala who cannot escape the relationship. So I'd like this court.
You'll have to remind me on RA because I'm not familiar with RA. Is the married woman married to somebody in Guatemala?
Right.
Islas Martinez is not married. This was a common law marriage in El Salvador, and she's currently married to Mr.
Yes, and that's the issue that I'd like to raise. Is it only a married woman in either Guatemala or El Salvador?
So you're not on all fours with RA. You're going to be an extension of RA.
Yes, and that's what I want to express to you. It was a common law marriage. She lived in a marital relationship with the prior husband, had a son with him. And so should the parameters of RA, if the case is remanded, be extended to women who live within a marital relationship, although it's not actually a legal marriage? Because in various countries in Central America, especially I know from...
Yeah, we know all that.
All right.
But as Judge Fletcher said, how do we get there? How do we get there procedurally?
Well, I think the DHS regulations give you the opportunity, although they haven't been written yet. We've been waiting for them to be written. The DHS brief alleging that at least a woman in RA's position should be granted asylum. Just by fact of that the DHS wrote that brief and that regulations are being promulgated and that she never had an opportunity to actually tell the... She's never had a hearing.
We've had a number of cases where, you know, we've declared a class of people, you know, it can be a family, where you've got an abusive father, or it can be Russian new entrepreneur. You know, we've got a number of those. But how do we get there procedurally? That's what Judge Fletcher wants. He teaches civil procedure.
Right.
He wants to know how you get there procedurally.
Well, I think
if
that
if you didn't have all those stumbling blocks,
right,
you wouldn't have a problem. So you have to tell us, how do we get there?
Well, the problem is that the government, we were waiting for the government to issue new law, because that would give us a real grounds for a motion to reopen, a motion to reconsider. We're waiting for these regulations.
Well,
the regulations haven't been
how
written.
How long were you entitled to wait?
Well,
you waited 2 years. That's out of the period that's specified by the regulations. Was BIA required to not to send your people out of the country until they had decided RA, and you had an opportunity to come in and argue that this is an extension of RA?
Well, we have argued that it's an extension of RA.
I understand that that's what you're arguing, but you're telling me that you had to wait for RA to come down. But you're an extension of RA. This is not RA.
Right.
So you're an aggressive extension of a decision that was pending that may or may not come out in favor of your client.
Exactly.
In the meantime, you sit on your rights, you delay more than 2 years, well outside of BIA's regs, and now the question is, well, how can we continue to review this? How long can we keep this record open?
Well, with many cases, of the whole class of NACARA applicants, their cases were reopened due to a class definition. People from El Salvador and Guatemala, their cases were reopened many years after their cases were originally heard. And we think that this is a similar situation.
They were part of an ongoing, big, huge class action, right?
But this is what...
Is that right?
Well, that's why I think, the reason why I think the Attorney General is...
part of an ongoing lawsuit.
This will be too, though. I mean, if
counsel, part of the challenge here is that you've had an opportunity to reopen and or make a motion to reopen or to reconsider before the BIA to urge them in the first instance, that is to be the RA. That is, you could have made Islas Martinez the lead case before the BIA on this question. And since it's not on all fours with RA, there was no reason that you had to wait. But you've sat on your rights now, and now it's very difficult to come forward and say, well, now we should have a second opportunity here, even though we sat on our hands for 2 years.
Well, we did file a motion to reopen, and there was a Ninth Circuit case filed. This is a second motion to reopen, and then a motion to reconsider based on new law. The DHS, it's not actually law, I mean, because it's only a brief, but it's determinative of what will be the law, I believe.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Cindy Farrier, and I'll be representing the Attorney General in this matter. I think the Court has recognized the procedural problems with the case, and that is, in fact, what the government's position is that there are procedural problems which prevent the Court from being able to do anything for petitioner in this particular case. The petitions for review filed in this case are from the dismissal of the denial of the cancellation of removal application.
So the government wants to kick these two people out, huh? Wants to send Ms. Benjivar back to El Salvador, and with all the things that have happened, and the daughter who was abused by her grandfather, who's seeing a psychologist, who was born here, what are we going to do with her?
That information, which was raised for the first time in the last motion to reopen, reconsider, the 2004 motion to reopen, reconsider. In that particular motion, they asserted ineffective assistance, and then at the end they mentioned in one paragraph that the daughter had been, or that the petitioner's daughter had been subject to molestation by the grandfather. That was the only paragraph. There was no further information about that. There was a supplemental declaration.
Well, who was representing the family at that time?
Present counsel. But just to make clear, the supplemental declaration, which actually details that particular abuse, the molestation, wasn't actually before the board by the time it made its decision. The board made its decision on that second motion to reopen on July 29th, 2004. The supplemental declaration was sent to the board on the very same day. So the board didn't actually have that that detailed information regarding the molestation until after it had rendered its decision.
Assume for a moment, and I'm not challenging the factual procedural narrative you just provided, but assume for a moment that the board had before it, as it was making its decision, not only the papers it did have, but also that one-page declaration of the mother. Would that have been a proper basis for the motion to reopen, including excusing the timeliness, because these are new facts?
That would have been a basis to reopen, to go all the way back, to reopen the cancellation of removal case. It would not have been a basis to raise the asylum application and the asylum claim based upon the domestic abuse. But it would, those new facts would relate to the underlying cancellation case.
And so that would be enough to provide reopening for the cancellation of removal.
Assuming that the board found that indeed those are facts that are supported and justify reopening, but if they did agree with that, then that would be a basis.
Yeah, the mother's declaration is pretty detailed. I mean, sometimes you read a declaration and you kind of scratch your head and say, boy, this doesn't sound right. Her declaration at AR06, I mean,
yeah.
They
still haven't attached any sort of documentation regarding the actual treatment that she's receiving, whether the treatment is ongoing at this point in time. That was filed in 2004. But assuming that they had information such as that and that there is treatment like that that is, in fact, going on, that might be a basis to reopen. But again, petitioners haven't asserted that before the board. And they didn't file any sort of motion to reconsider the motion to reconsider. I'm not sure if they weren't aware.
A lot of all these problems arise because the BIA tolerates these notarios and the string of lawyers that they hire. Many of them have been disbarred, and you know the government knows that's going on. And it goes on and on. You got poor people. They're in a strange, in a new country. They don't really understand the language. They go and take them in a room, and somebody starts filling out a few things and not paying too much attention to them. The government knows that goes on. So the government's hands aren't clean, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, in this particular...
They need to clean that situation up over there.
And
provide counsel for these people and not accept disbarred lawyers as adequate counsel. And the slogan, a disbarred lawyer is better than no lawyer. I mean, I've heard them tell me that. We're all guilty of this, every one of us.
In this particular case, the counsel who was disbarred, Walter Burrier, who they assert all the claims about ineffective assistance
Burrier,
against.
What is a farrier? Someone puts horseshoes on. What's a burrier do? He's a guy that comes in and roughs it up first.
I don't know. But Mr. Burrier, in fact, was not the counsel that represented them before the immigration judge. He did appear with them at the master calendar hearing, and simply he did a plea to the notice to appear. And he withdrew their asylum application, but he did not.
How much time did he spend with them?
It looks as though he appeared with them on their August 1997 hearing and their September 1997 hearing. But by November, they had new counsel, Linda Howard, who, in fact, they haven't asserted any ineffective assistance of counsel against, and
Was she tied up with a notarios?
There's no indication that she's associated with them, and petitioners haven't asserted that in any of their filings to the court. She has separate addresses and doesn't seem to indicate that she was affiliated with Burrier. But nonetheless, the hearing before the immigration judge regarding the cancellation of removal application was by her. And with regard to the facts that petitioner is now asserting the unconscionable standard, that the IJ applied the wrong standard in evaluating their hardship, that is something that they did not allege in their motion to reopen the second one.
Because they've got incompetent lawyers.
By this time, it was present counsel.
This body of law is, as far as I'm concerned, twice as complicated as the Internal Revenue Code, plus throw in the sentencing guidelines. And you've got notarios advising these people and disbarred lawyers advising them. I mean, it's just a disgrace. It really is.
Just to make clear, here the petitioners had present counsel at the time they filed their second or their first motion to reopen, asserting asylum on domestic violence. They didn't file the petition for review from that particular decision. Then they waited a year and a half before they filed the second motion.
Yeah.
And so it is present counsel that was there. Let me ask you this.
I think Ms. Wood is right to say that we do have jurisdiction on a direct petition for review of a BIA decision denying cancellation of removal where it is apparent that the wrong standard was used. We don't have jurisdiction, assuming they recite the right standard and they just evaluate the facts in this way that I might personally agree or disagree. I've got nothing to say about that. And I do recognize that the IJ was in a bit of a fix because at that early stage, the law hadn't quite settled out as to what this level of hardship meant, and the IJ did use the word unconscionable, which is not quite the standard. What if we were to remand to the BIA for application of a proper standard? Would that be a wrong thing to do in this case?
I believe that it would be because the board issued its decision after it had developed its case law on Matter of Monreal and these other cases. And it mentions Matter of Monreal, and it has reevaluated the hardship and has determined that the immigration judge's hardship determination was appropriate in light of its intervening case law.
So the only basis on which we can remand for redetermination of hardship would be the new facts?
I believe so. But again, those aren't, they haven't been reasserted by petitioner before the board. They weren't all properly before the board.
Well, they were reasserted before the board in this last motion to reopen, although you're absolutely right to say it's pretty brief. It was at the very end. They just say subjected to, I just read it. 2004, respondent's daughter was sexually abused, is now under psychiatric care. These facts were unavailable. It doesn't even say by whom and so on. And this declaration that shows up, you're absolutely right, is sent in on the 29th, which is precisely the same date and so on.
What's your
sense as to what might happen as a practical matter if the BIA or the back to the IJ was to have, if the IJ were to have this sexual molestation documented as we now have it, perhaps even with some testimony on remand, is there a shot at cancellation or removal based on hardship based on this?
I don't believe that it's appropriate for me to make the determination, but certainly...
I'm trying to decide if it's futile.
Hardship relating to the children is what is critical in a cancellation.
It's hardship to the citizen, that's correct. So, and the child is a citizen.
Yeah. So, but again, it would need to be clear that these people are, in fact, that she is, in fact, still in counseling, that just more documentation regarding the
what are the alternatives? Obviously, if they were to take the child back to Central America, well, she's away from the grandfather. On the other hand, there's apparently some bad uncle down there who rapes children, too.
Again, that would be something for the board to evaluate in determining whether reopening.
Would you object to sending it back for reopening just on the question of hardship based on these facts?
I object in the sense that this case has been mishandled procedurally.
Yes, it has been. I think we're all on the same page with that.
Certainly if petitioner had additional information that she wished to provide. I guess my position would be if she has additional information regarding the child that she needs to provide, then the appropriate thing would be, again, to file another motion with the board to let them consider it. So,
it's all right to be kind, even though you're with the Department of Justice.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I know you're struggling.
Anyway, unless the court has any further questions for me.
Well, I do have another question. I think you probably are not in a position to answer it, and I don't want you to put you in a position where you have to go beyond your authority. But the Board reacts very differently to motions that are joint motions to reopen. Would the government consider a joint motion to reopen on the question of not asylum, but rather on the question of hardship?
The government always is amenable to considering joint motions to reopen. That is something that the Department of Homeland Security, the local office, I have heard, is quite backed up in requests such as that. But certainly, if Petitioner's Counsel chose to do something like that, we would be willing to, if the court wished to hold it in abeyance, this particular decision in abeyance, while the department considered that particular a joint motion.
Ready to do that?
We would be willing to do that.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Sure.
Well, I think we're getting there, all right? So.
As far as holding on to this evidence, we learned about it. The minute we learned about the child's abuse, we got the declaration from the mother and FedExed it to the Board, and we just acted as quickly as – there's a lot of shame involved in this case. When people suffer abuse, when people suffer domestic violence, when children suffer – it actually wasn't only sexual abuse, it was incest. There's a lot of shame, and people are not necessarily quickly forthcoming with that information. As soon as we obtained it, on all levels, we let the various parties know. So we would be amenable to doing another motion to reopen. Of course. We'd do anything, actually, to help this woman.
Okay.
Thanks. All right. Matter submitted.